Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber, your host. On today's show, permissionless innovation. Should innovators and entrepreneurs have to get permission from the government or regulators before experimenting with new business models and products? Or should the assumption be that innovators and entrepreneurs should be left alone as long as consumers are not harmed? Joining me to discuss this is Adam Thierer, author of Permissionless Innovation and Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at the Tech Policy Program. Adam, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So your book kind of lays out two competing visions of how to regulate technology. One of them is permissionless innovation, the title of your book. The other is the precautionary principle. Can you take listeners through the difference there?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, basically, permissionless innovation generally refers to a freedom to experiment with new technologies and innovations free from prior restraint. The idea is that basically you should be able as an innovator or a creator of a new technology to go out and release it into the wild and let people try it without having the government or somebody else tell you that you can. By contrast, precautionary principle basically refers to the idea that we should limit new innovations until such time as innovators have essentially received the blessing from someone, usually in a government agency or regulatory agency, that basically says, you're okay to do this now, you have our blessing. And this sort of tension we see at work in almost every single technology policy debate today.
And which of those debates would you say really make that distinction pronounced in the most profound way?
Sure. Well, there's quite a few. I'll just reel off a couple of them and then highlight the ones that I think are most important. Clearly, things like 3D printing, virtual reality, Internet of Things, and wearable technology, driverless cars, drones, so on and so forth. I think the sector or technology where we see this tension brought to life most frequently in the news these days is the sharing economy. Clearly, the kind of thing you're seeing in terms of the backlash against Uber and Airbnb and so on and so forth, often driven by a precautionary principle-based impulse to say like, well, let's wait and see. Is this going to disrupt various sectors or labor laws? Or is it safe? Is it secure enough? So on and so forth. And these sorts of tensions drive the backlash against these new innovations. Whereas I think most of the boosters of these technologies, including myself, would say, no, look at the benefits of allowing for permissionless innovation in this field. You know, it's great that Uber and Airbnb and others did not have to ask for permission, that they went out and did these things, because we had never heretofore enjoyed serious competition and choice in some of those fields.
And there's a bit of a misnomer that companies like Uber and Airbnb are unregulated. And I think most people, because tech has been so successful and it seems like companies kind of just do what they want and they can succeed and they're not constantly being regulated or the subject of big regulatory debates like the financial sector. But it's not like these companies are unregulated. We talk about the Federal Trade Commission on this show before. They're in charge of consumer protection. They have policies about unfairness and deception that apply to all companies, whether it's an app or it's not an app.
That's right. You know, permissionless innovation should not be viewed as being synonymous with anarchy.
Right.
The reality is that just because you don't have prior restraint on innovations and new technologies doesn't mean that there aren't other types of remedies when things go wrong. You already mentioned, of course, the FTC and unfair and deceptive practices authority that it has. Well, other state authorities have that same sort of power, state AGs, so on and so forth. But even before we get to that, we have things like contract law and property law. We have torts and other common law remedies. We have product defects law. We have nuisance and negligence. We have all sorts of other types of things in our legal toolbox. In my book, I talk about Richard Epstein's phrase for this, which he says, simple rules for a complex world. That's what we really need going forward. We do live in a very complicated world, and technology seems to make it more complicated in some ways. But the reality is that those old timeless principles, especially the common law principles, probably still work just as well if we just give them a chance. And this reflects the important distinction between the permissionless innovation camp and the precautionary principle camp, because those of us who believe in permissionless innovation want to wait and see what problems develop and then rely on more of an ex post enforcement regime if it's needed at all to address whatever problems develop, most of which we cannot anticipate in advance. By contrast, the precautionary principle crowd would say, no, we need ex ante approaches, sort of before the fact kind of approaches that would say, let's anticipate every possible thing that could go wrong and somehow address it by law. The fundamental problem with that is that if you spend all of your time obsessing about hypothetical worst case scenarios and basing public policy upon worst case scenarios, then best case scenarios can never come about.
Right. So with permissionless innovation, the ostensible benefit is that you'll get more innovation, consumers will be better off. And I guess the risk there that regulators see is that with something like drones, that if drones are unregulated and people are allowed to fly drones wherever and, you know, use them for various purposes, that somehow we'll have air safety issues and they'll be falling out of the sky and hitting people. But again, these are such worst case scenarios. And I guess in the vast majority of cases, we had your colleague Eli on the show to say that if you really think about it, the small drones that the FAA requires kids to register with the government for $5, it's basically like adding a bunch of birds to the sky. So the idea that tiny little drones are going to be taking out 747 airliners is kind of ridiculous. But I guess if you're a regulator and you see your inability to keep up as inherently a problem, that's different than maybe your definition of a problem, which is actual consumer harm, which is someone proving that consumers have somehow been made worse off. But there are people who probably think that innovation outpacing the ability of government to regulate is itself a problem, and that innovation needs to be slowed down to a level where a bureaucracy can handle it.
Yeah, this is the so-called pacing problem,
right,
that is referred to in the literature on the philosophy of technology. And every book I see out there today, and every sort of panicky, techno-panicky newspaper headline or blog post about whatever emerging technology it is that people fear, often ends up by saying, if we don't get out ahead of this problem, then, oh my gosh, what will happen? And sort of that's worst case thinking. And it happens again and again, as I've already suggested. Again, the better alternative is to wait and see and have some regulatory humility and patience, because we can't always plan what the worst case is. And it's, to be sure, there are things that are going to go wrong. We are going to have accidents. But I mean, to give you a really concrete example, think about risk trade-offs in the context of driverless car technology. There are some people who want to see precautionary principle-based regulation of driverless cars, saying until they're perfectly safe and hack-proof, we shouldn't allow them on the road. Well, let's take the operational baseline in the debate over driverless cars. Today, 92 people will die in America behind a wheel. 6,500 people will be injured. That happens every day in the United States. That's the operational baseline. Why? Because 93 to 94% of these accidents are caused by human error. I have to believe that any move, even an incremental one in the direction of driverless car and intelligent vehicle technology, is going to bring down that death toll significantly. And I would argue that people are holding back progress based on worst case scenarios with driverless cars. They have blood on their hands. These are people that are foregoing huge public health benefits associated with driverless car technology.
And you have to be willing to accept that it might be a messy process, that there's going to be maybe someday in the future we're going to have all driverless cars.
Right.
But there's going to be a middle period where it's a combination. Maybe driverless cars start out very small percentage on the road, and then it goes up and up and up, and they're interacting with older vehicles that are not necessarily going to be outlawed. Right. There's going to be some humans driving, some computers driving, and there's going to be concerns about privacy. There's going to be concerns about ethics. How does a driverless car make decisions in life or death scenarios? That's like a philosophy 101 debate about the train that's careening and doesn't kill the five people,
the
one people. Right. These are all important questions, but I guess the risk with precautionary principle is that those things might take a very long time figure out. And we as a society might have a very long and important discussion of ethics. But in the meantime, telling GM, Google, Apple, and everyone else to just pump the brakes when the potential life-saving capability, the drunk driving problem, there's really limitless possibilities here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not confident that the Department of Transportation and others are going to be able to keep up with all of these problems in a way that granting permission will allow them to innovate at the level they would be able to do without permission.
Yeah, that's right. It's also the case that we're not even sure exactly which problems will creep up. A lot of the things that people obsess about in terms of problems with new technologies ultimately don't materialize, but it's other things that we did not foresee in advance that become more problematic. That could certainly be the case with driverless car technology or drones or whatever else. Right now, it's very easy to imagine scenarios like, oh my gosh, driverless cars getting hacked or drones peeping into our windows and things that are driven by sort of like science fiction and popular culture narratives about, you know, dystopian technologies. The reality is it could be something far more mundane or different that goes wrong. And there's a benefit to allowing ongoing experimentation, because the experiential value alone, the value of actually learning through failure and trial and error, is profound. That's ultimately how we prosper as a species and as a society and economy. In my book, I argue and provide case studies of the difference between our country and how it related policy to the internet and information technology versus how other countries and continents did, who were so concerned about potential failures often involving privacy and security that they preemptively regulated, only to realize that by doing so, they didn't get any of the benefits or any of the industries or companies and technologies.
And it might be counterintuitive because it's not like Europeans don't have access to technology and it's not like they don't have internet access, but there are real data and numbers to suggest that their approach to the commercial internet, which for our purposes is about 20 years old, has really harmed them. And one number is that the top 10 technology companies in the world are either in the US or China.
That's right.
That's pretty telling because it's not like China doesn't regulate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the book, I provide data about this and basically highlight the fact that all of the world's leading innovators in the tech space, information technology space, are largely American companies. They're household names across the globe. Meanwhile, when I talk about these issues or I testify in Congress, I often ask for people to say, like, hey, name me a European tech company. Anybody.
Spotify, give me somebody. That's it.
Somebody will say Spotify. Sometimes people will say Skype. And I say, well, that's been owned by an American company or two now for 15 years. Every once in a while, somebody will say Rovio, like the maker of Angry Birds. I'm like, okay, whatever. I'll give you that one, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, but video games are their own kind of category.
But the reality is, I mean, the numbers are just staggering. I mean, you look at like Europe's tech unicorns, billion-dollar companies relative to America's tech unicorns. Europe has about $120 billion in tech unicorns in the aggregate. Facebook is double that alone. Apple is about triple that. Airbnb alone is bigger than all of Germany's tech unicorns. I mean, these are huge imbalances. And meanwhile, all the VC money has flocked to U.S. shores.
Right.
Basically, as I point out in the book, we live in a world of global innovation arbitrage, and America won these battles. We have all the innovators, all the money flocking to our shores for information technology for the most part. Now, that could, of course, reverse itself with all these other new emerging technologies we're talking about, drones, driverless cars, you know, biotechnology, nanotech, robotics. We could start see, and I argue in a new paper, that we are starting to see a lot of companies leave U.S. shores and look elsewhere for more hospitable environments in which they can invest without fear of precautionary principle regulation.
Yeah, you don't want to take for granted the success that we've had. And just because we are the dominant player today doesn't mean that's always going to be the case. And it's interesting you bring up the European example because a counter argument to the unicorn thing might be, well, all right, so you're talking about massive companies, but that doesn't mean Europe doesn't have a small business tech sector. And certainly France and Amsterdam, they have smaller companies that are doing innovative things. But it's important to point out the mentality of those companies and what their goals are. So we had Massimiliano Trovato from a libertarian think tank in Milan on the show. And what he said is, it's not that Europe doesn't have tech companies. It's that their vision of success is not becoming a giant successful company in Europe. Their vision of success is get bought out by an American company. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of depressing. If you're a European patriot to the extent that Europe has a universal identity, but even if you're just a French person who wants France to succeed, and the end game is being bought out by an American company because they are in awe and marvel of the culture in Silicon Valley and they want to be a part of that. Whereas it would be much better if that continent and those countries could figure out policies where people are incentivized to stay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And frankly, if they don't do this, they're going to have another lost decade on their hands. They've already lost the first round of the web wars, if you will, and they're at risk of losing the next with things like the Internet of Things and wearable technology, a lot of these other things. But some countries are changing. The United Kingdom, for example, I document this in the book, has some government agencies and officials that are sort of going out and actively recruiting tech companies, including ones from America, to come to the UK and invest there. They're setting up like areas where they can go and do driverless car technology, drones and Bitcoin and things like this. And again, in a world of global innovation arbitrage, that actually might work. They might start peeling some companies off. Probably the most instructive example that we've seen recently is 23andMe. You know, our Food and Drug Administration went after 23andMe for providing genetic testing information to the average person out there for $99. This is an amazing innovation. You think about this. The FDA said, no, we don't want people having more information about themselves. What would they do with that information? It's like, God forbid we know more about ourselves, right? So what happened? Immediately immediately, folks in the UK who in the government basically said, well, here we are with welcoming arms, come over here and offer those products and services. So we might see that same thing happen with robotics, with driverless car technology, AI, so on and so forth, Bitcoin. We're seeing it with drones in Canada, Australia, and others like Google and Amazon have been moving there to do drone testing. So it could be that just because America did so well in the first round of the sort of modern tech wars, that in the second round, they really lose a lot of ground to a lot of these other countries and continents. I don't think it's going to be one continent or country in particular, but it could be several. And I'm really worried because a lot of the new innovations that we're seeing today are in sectors that are so heavily regulated in the United States, specifically fintech, financial tech, health tech, transportation tech. Those are three areas where the greatest potential exists for some really life-enriching disruptive innovation. And yet technologies that move into that space are moving into a space that's sort of like what I call born in captivity regulatory captivity.
I was going to ask you about the distinction you draw in the book where there are technologies that to a casual listener, they might think they're all kind of in the same boat, but there are some technologies that are very successful that succeed despite regulation. And then those are the ones that you say are born in captivity or purgatory. And there are others that actually had kind of a blank check to innovate. Right. And could you give an example?
Yeah, they're born free, as I say.
Could you give an example for each category?
Well, first of all, the internet is the best example, right? I mean, it was born into an environment where the FCC didn't have control and we didn't give it any control of the internet for the most part, although the FCC is trying to exert more control over it. But obviously, for the most part, tech innovators, you know, the Facebooks of the world, the Apples, the Microsofts, the Yahoos, the Googles, they didn't have to come and get anybody's blessing or a license to do any of those wonderful innovations over the past 20 years. Another more modern technology that is also similarly born free, if you will, is 3D printing. It's really interesting to see all the things that are being done with 3D printers, many of which sort of butt up against existing policies, but there is no 3D printing oversight body, law, or agency. So it's essentially born free. To some extent, that's also true for virtual reality. It's not as true, however, for things like I've already mentioned 23andMe, I've already mentioned drones, heavily regulated by the FAA already, driverless cars, NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. All of these agencies are going to limit what a lot of these technology providers can do. So this is this distinction between being sort of born free versus born in captivity, because if you face an onslaught of precautionary-based regulations, you're going to have to figure out how to overcome those. And while it's certainly true, as Marc Andreessen, the venture capitalist, suggests that software is eating the world, the reality is that software eats some parts of the world more easily than others. And we're seeing this clash of visions really start to come forth in these areas that I've identified, where the freedom of the internet and distributed digital technologies is butting up against old regulatory red tape and law.
And when you are born in captivity, there are, as you mentioned, ways to combat that. And in the example of Uber, that is not a particularly innovative technology. It's not that high tech, the fact that the app pairs you with a driver or whatever. That's not exactly remarkable for 2016. What's remarkable is the business model. That's where the innovation happened. And we talk about permissionless innovation. They didn't ask for permission. They didn't have permission. They decided to ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
And the reason it worked is because they would just come into a city guns blazing, hire as many drivers as they could, sign up as many people, give people free rides to all these things. And then by the time these slow moving bureaucrats could even figure out what the hell was going on, it was almost too late.
That's right.
Because then you have tens of thousands of lobbyists called happy users that will go to bat for you. And we saw the example we talked about on the show in New York City with Bill de Blasio, a relatively popular progressive mayor, at least with the demographics that use Uber, typically young people. They tend to like progressive mayors, but they were pissed. And a lot of them were people of color who are like, I'm sorry, are you going to force yellow cabs to take me because I'm a person of color? Because that's been a problem I've had my whole life. And Uber has kind of solved that problem. So I would like for you not to cap the number of drivers because that will prevent me from getting home in the rain. So it's in certain instances, it's easier to ask for forgiveness. But then there are cases like with drones where you can't just start operating like near an airport without the airport first deregulating, or there's not.
This is a really good point. I think that I often, to be provocative when I'm lecturing at law schools or in front of philosophy classes, will start by saying something like, you know, what are Uber and Airbnb today if not two of the biggest lawbreakers in America? And God bless them for it.
Yeah.
And basically I point out that look, if not for a certain amount of that sort of permissionless innovation and disruptive tech, we would not have ever been able to taste of these waters, these what it looks like to have competitive options and choices in these sectors. I mean, let's not forget, the whole reason we have so heavily regulated transportation services historically is because of a lack of competition and consumer choice. And finally, a technology provider came along and created a business model that offered it to us after about 7 or 8 decades of government trying. This is an amazing success story, but it only came about precisely because somebody went out there and did something truly disruptive, disrupting the law in this case, and basically said, no, we're going to go our own way and ask for forgiveness later. What they also did, as you've already suggested, is they, by giving people these choices, letting them taste of these waters, basically said, hey, here you go. Do you want this option taken away? And in the process created an army of citizen lobbyists, if you will, who then go to bat, whether it's against Mayor de Blasio or any state or local government that basically tries to stop these choices. Doesn't always work. Didn't work so well in Austin recently, but you know, in most cases, they're winning that battle for hearts and minds and therefore changing the law. Recently, two scholars from Harvard University and Harvard Business Review referred to this phenomenon as spontaneous deregulation, which is a really lovely phrase because it basically nicely captures what's happening. We're not getting actual legal deregulation. Not much on the books is changing in a lot of cases, but what we are getting is something that is essentially de facto deregulation that's spontaneously occurring as people are given new options, exercise them, and everybody just says, well, let's turn a blind eye to the fact that they're breaking laws here, because technically they are. And of course, as you pointed out, in the context of drones or driverless cars, it would be much, much harder because the government controls the infrastructure in these cases. And if you go out and do anything in the airways without the government's permission, the FAA will come down on you hard. If you do anything on a road without government's permission, the government will come down on you hard. They know where to find you. They know you have deep pockets and they'll sue you out of existence. Small-time innovators might actually be able to break through at the margins, and they are doing it for drones, but not so much for driverless cars. But still, it's hard to get effective change in those contexts. Same thing for financial services. I mean, Bitcoin may change that, but we're still, I think, theorizing about that sort of radical disruption. It hasn't really, we haven't really seen it yet.
So what do you think the breaking point will be? So if there are industries like health where the stakes are very high and a lack of or an inability to embrace telemedicine could actually be a life or death scenario, you could envision that regulators might pick and choose which industries they decide are more urgent, for lack of a better word, to kind of allow or give permission or right. not ask for permission.
Yeah.
So you could see regulators saying, well, healthcare is obviously an important one. Yep. So even the FCC with its heavy-handed internet rules that we've lambasted on the show before, they might say, well, if there's going to be an exception, remote video surgery should be an exception. Yeah. But for something like finance, where they say, well, where's the fire? We have banks, they're stable, partly because we bailed them out, but that's a different podcast. And you know, everyone has, you know, they can get credit. So why do we need to rush the embrace of Bitcoin in a first world country that has a stable currency? Is that the real danger, that they pick and choose and don't apply the same principle to all industries?
Yeah, that's a very real danger. Here's what I think is the sort of regulatory strategy for a lot of agencies going forward. I think on one hand, they still are going to look around for, are there large, deep-pocketed intermediaries they can go after and make an example of? Is there somebody like a 23andMe that they can go out and sue or drive, you know, out of the business? And then hope that that sort of teaches everybody the proverbial lesson that, like, don't you mess with us or our laws, right? That's a hard strategy if you have highly decentralized, distributed forms of innovation. For example, who do you go after in the world of 3D printing because you don't like somebody doing voluntary 3D printing of, say, the prosthetic limbs? That's happening right there, right out there today. I mean, people are making in a voluntary way prosthetic hands for kids with limb deficiencies. Who do you sue? You don't go after 3D printer makers. You don't go after 3D printed marketplaces. You can't go after the inputs. It's, what is it, plastics, you know, and glue. You can't go after the design blueprints. That's a First Amendment issue. So in these cases, when there isn't a large intermediary or gatekeeper to go after, the regulatory playbook switches and it changes to sort of the so-called proverbial multi-stakeholder process that is now like the new model of governance for so many different sectors and technologies. And in these contexts, what the government does is say, well, we can't go out and beat down the big dogs. So instead, we'll just get as many players at a table as possible and drop sort of best practices or codes of conduct or industry guidance. Now, I'll say this, that's probably better than the old command and control thou shalt not playbook, where they sort of did everything in a top-down way. The downside, however, of like trying to have the government convene multi-stakeholder processes or come up with best practices or industry guidance is that it's a very arbitrary process. You're not exactly sure, are we operating in the confines of the law or not? Who's it applied to? What about future technologies and companies that haven't come about yet? There's all sorts of uncertainties with that process. And yet, mark my words, in sector after sector that we're talking about here today, that's going to become the primary way of doing business. The FDA, for example, that's exactly what they're doing for 3D printing. That's also what they're doing for mobile medical apps on phones. They're really not sure what to do about all these things that people are voluntarily coding and putting up on stores, like saying, here's a new medical app or a health and fitness app. They can't possibly go after all of it. They can't regulate these things because apps fly into the app store in and out every day, thousands of times. But they can drop best practices and then try to encourage everybody to adopt them. Whether or not that works, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, and the danger there is that if the government's at the table and a bunch of large companies are at the table, the question is who's not at the table. Mm-hmm. And if it's small players, both government and large companies can use the process to adopt a set of best practices that only large companies can adhere to. It's very easy to imagine that a privacy regime for Uber might be something that a $50 billion company can easily comply with, but not a smaller company. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's always the concern. But there are reasons to be optimistic. As we've mentioned, there are industries that were born in captivity yet still managed to be super successful. There are industries like 3D printing where regulation is almost infeasible in some ways. Like it's not even, like how are you going to regulate what some guy does with a 3D printer in his house? Are you going to go door to door and knock them down? But then there are real reasons for concern. And the question is not, are we going to be living in a tech dystopia? Is everything going to be awful? It's really just, it's hard to know what you miss out on. If there's a prior restraint, and it's the known unknown of like what technology did I not see because of the regulatory situation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and this is generally why hopefully our regulators will come around to understanding that there's real benefits to allowing for this sort of experimentation or so-called permissionless innovation. I don't know if it'll always be the case. There are going to be agencies that'll push back. I'm confident that a lot of public officials are coming around. I'm even confident that those who are using this sort of multi-stakeholder best practices systems are at least willing today to acknowledge the benefits and at least willing to have a discussion about them. We've really have come a ways since the old days when we'd have agencies just basically shut down a lot of these things preemptively is at the first glance that they weren't getting someone's blessing. So we have made some important strides. The new sort of model is not perfect, but even with its flaws, I think it's going to provide a path forward where we're going to start to see more and more Ubers and Airbnbs emerge in other sectors of the economy. That's the hope.
Well, that's it for today's show. The book is Permissionless Innovation. The author is Adam Thier, Senior Research Fellow with the Technology Policy Program at the Mercatus Center, a research center based at George Mason University. You can buy the book on Amazon, and we will link to that in the show notes. Adam, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks again for having me.
Let us know what you think of the show. As I mentioned, we're testing out new equipment to try to deal with our audio problems. So let us know on Twitter at TechFreedom or on Facebook.com/TechFreedom. Send us an email with ideas for the show, topics you'd like to hear, guests you'd like to see at media@TechFreedom.org. And please leave us a review in the iTunes store. It will help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.